welcome into Ally Radio for this Friday, September 29th, 2023. I'm Noah Glick, Executive Editor of SierraNevadaAlly.org. On this week's show, we look ahead to an event this weekend commemorating the 160th anniversary of the Treaty of the Ruby Valley. This agreement from 1863 was between the Western Shoshone people and the U.S. government, and it allowed colonial settlers to travel through and use the land of the Western Shoshone. What it didn't do, though, was cede land to the U.S. government. Coming up on Ally Radio, a conversation about that treaty, what it means, and a look at an event this weekend meant to educate the community on the long-lasting effects of this treaty, which Indigenous people say represent broken promises. Then, not to brag or anything, but the Sierra Nevada Ally has won 5 awards from the Nevada Press Association for our impact journalism. So this week, we're bringing you a rebroadcast of one of those award winners, an explanatory piece from the Sierra Nevada Ally's Scott King. But before we get into all of that, let's start with some headlines. Hospitality workers on the Las Vegas Strip have authorized a strike while the labor union continues negotiations with casino operators. Members of the culinary and bartender unions voted 95% in favor to authorize a citywide strike earlier this week. No deadline has been set, but the vote means the culinary union can call for a strike at any date or time. The union says it continues to work in good faith with casino operators. The strike would affect 22 casino resorts on the Las Vegas Strip, including MGM, Caesars, and Wynn Encore Resorts. 40,000 workers at those three resorts are working under an expired contract and are looking for a new 5-year deal. MGM has made headlines in recent weeks due to a large-scale cyber attack that shut down computer systems and forced the business to operate many aspects with people. And sticking with casinos, the city of Reno is preparing for its largest private capital investment in history, about $1 billion, and it's to update the Grand Sierra Resort. GSR owner Alex Morello was in town this week to announce the investment, which he says will, quote, transform GSR into a destination where community, sports, and entertainment come together, end quote. The plans for the investment include a new 10,000-seat arena designed to host events and eventually the Nevada Wolfpack men's basketball team. Additionally, there are plans to upgrade Grand Bay with an aqua golf facility, a walking path, and water show, much like the fountains at the Bellagio in Las Vegas. According to a press release, there will also be a new 800-room hotel tower, parking garage, and approximately 300 affordable housing units for the increased workforce needed to handle increased demand. Morello also owns the National Hockey League's Arizona Coyotes, but according to reporting from The Athletic, since Morello took ownership of the team in 2019, the franchise has been embroiled in controversy. That includes not paying players their signing bonuses, withholding overtime compensation for staff, and threatening litigation in order to pay lower amounts to vendors. That includes a public relations firm in Las Vegas, which represented SLS Las Vegas Resort and Casino. The $1 billion investment will be made over the next 10 years. Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo announced an economic cooperation memorandum of understanding this week with the province of Ontario, Canada. Lombardo met with Premier Doug Ford and signed an agreement that is related to critical minerals and green energy projects. The agreement is a pledge to work on trade agreements between Nevada and Ontario related to battery and electric vehicle technology, mining development, renewable and green energy development, implementation and storage, and strategic supply chain for mining and critical minerals. Lombardo said in a statement, the agreement is based on Nevada's strong mining sectors, and by working with Ontario, he is hoping to, quote, maximize emerging export opportunities, end quote. Lithium, the metal component used in lithium-ion batteries for EVs, is one critical mineral that has huge economic potential for the state. In fact, a lithium deposit in northern Nevada is considered to be the largest in the world. We at the Ally are looking into that lithium project, the Thacker Pass lithium mine, and we'll share our reporting in the coming weeks. It's been 160 years since the U.S. government entered into a treaty with the Western Shoshone people, but tribal members say the treaty is a testament to broken promises. The 1863 Treaty of the Ruby Valley was meant to be a friendship agreement between the Western Shoshone and U.S. settlers making their way west. But that hasn't been the case. This weekend, Great Basin College in Elko is hosting a three-day event in partnership with the NUA Knowledge Center to educate the public about this treaty and its long-term impacts. I recently spoke with Mary Gibson, member of the Timok Tribe of Western Shoshone Elko Band and executive director of the NUA Knowledge Center, as well as Fermina Stevens, a member of the Timok Tribe of Western Shoshone and executive director of the Western Shoshone Defense Project. Wanted to learn more about this treaty and this weekend's events, and here's part of our conversation. Just to kind of get us started, because, you know, there is an event, but before we get into that, it seems like it coincides with the 160th anniversary of the 1863 Ruby Valley Treaty. So I don't know who wants to answer this, but can someone just give me an overview of what was that treaty and what was the significance of that?
So the 1863 Ruby Valley Treaty is a treaty of peace. And a treaty of friendship. The treaty allowed the United States to take their journey across Western Shoshone territory in 1863. Historically, there had been some conflict between United States, between settlers and the Western Shoshone as they were crossing Western Shoshone and territory. And so the United States had a need to make a treaty of peace and friendship. The treaty originally happened because, as I understand from my elders during the Civil War, there were many people going to get to reach the California gold fields. And because of many issues with the Western Shoshone at that time, mainly the fact that much of our ancestors' food supply was being denigrated by the colonial settlers' livestock. They were eating much of our people's food supply. The Western Shoshone existed in the Great Basin, and our ancestors depended mainly upon plants as their food source. And so some of the conflict happened simply because our people were protecting land and people. And therefore, they were doing what they could by the dwindling food supply. And so there were raids against the United States citizens, and also the United States and settlers, I guess I can say, fought back. So there was a lot of conflict that was happening in 1863.
And so, you know, flash forward to the 1940s and the Indian Claims Commission. We went through an Indian Claims Commission process where a lot of to state federal court ended up in the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court basically, you know, just said, yeah, we took your land and carry on. So we went to the United Nations and the United Nations Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination determined that, yes, indeed, the human rights of the Western Shoshones were violated. Our right to due process, our right to equality before the law, and our right to property. So our treaty is still valid. We never ceded any land. And right now we're just trying to protect the land and water for future use, for, you know, for the future of Nevada. Because with everything going on in Nevada, you know, who knows what's going to happen with our water and food sources as, you know, we move along in the next 50, 60 years and beyond. And so as far as our treaty goes, we're still trying to figure out what we're wanting to do with it, what we can do with it. If we want to proceed lawfully, legally through the court system, because the title to our land has never been litigated. So further litigation on our title is an option that we need to talk about. And we're hoping to talk about some of that during this treaty conference.
That's interesting. Yeah. Like one of the things I saw reading about the treaty was that there was no land that was ceded. But, you know, you look at any map and it's you have the border of Nevada straight up to, you know, Utah and elsewhere. So, I mean, I guess I know that you can't get into the exacts, but like, what is the border of the land that of the Western Shoshone people?
There are very specific boundaries in the treaty, and it goes up north into Idaho and parts of Utah and down through, you know, a good 2/3 portions of Nevada and down into Death Valley, California. So we're talking a vast territory that we were in, and it's all in the treaty. It's all in the treaty. And so if you Google Ruby Valley treaty map or something like that, it'll pop right up.
I'd like to add also that the treaty, and this is United States law, as stated in the Constitution, Article 6, that treaties are the supreme law of the land. And unfortunately, in our case, the Western Shoshone case, the United States doesn't seem to see it that way, specifically in regards to our ancestral and treaty boundaries. They don't recognize that treaty. They did recognize it. They did recognize in the treaty that these are our boundaries. The United States knew very well that this was the boundary of the Western Shoshone. And though they recognized in 1863, they're totally ignoring it to this day. And as you had stated, Noah, there is a lot of land projects going out on the land that we are denied. And so we do have a lot of large land projects going on currently. And as we know, in our treaty, you know, we did agree to give permission to the United States to do certain things. And those certain things included mining. But mining was in no way had the impact as it does today with the growth of technology. Mining, the mining industry is pretty much allowed to destroy a lot of landscape, and all that landscape is majorly culturally significant. As our people have lived all over in what is now called the state of Nevada, we lived in every valley and mountain ranges in Nevada. We weren't a central unit, but we were, you know, extended throughout our treaty territory. And so along with mining, ranching was, we gave the United States to have U.S. citizens establish ranching and settlements, and also transportation, which meant telegraphs and also the railroad company. So our people agreed at that time to share the land. And today, that's not the case at all. We barely are able to establish any jurisdiction over our treaty lands. And the reservations and colonies that make up part of the Western Shoshone base here, those were not established through the treaty. Those were executive orders because historically our people did not want to leave the treaty area. They did not want to leave within our treaty boundaries. The government established the Duck Valley Indian Reservation as promised in the treaty. The U.S. government would establish a reservation for the Western Shoshone as they saw fit, but that did not occur because the Shoshones refused to move to Duck Valley. That was outside of our treaty boundary, as well as where Thacker Pass is. That does not include Western Shoshone land. And so a lot of what was determined through that treaty is not abided by through the United States today.
I am curious. I want to shift now to the event. Can you just give us an overview, either one, whoever wants to answer? Can we just hear an overview of what the event is all about and what you're hoping to kind of get out of this?
Our mission is to educate. That's the main mission of NUA Knowledge Center. And we're also concerned with cultural preservation. We have lost a lot of our Indigenous knowledge. And so we need to restore and revive the things that we lost. And with that in mind, I was looking to our elders to share their stories, to share their oral narratives of what they remembered during treaty time, because I believe, you know, families spoke about this and groups of Western Shoshone spoke about the treaty. And for me, it was really important to be able to document this information so that the future, our future Western Shoshone people would know exactly what happened and what was the condition and what were the reasons and how it impacts us today. That was my main insight about having this treaty conference.
That was Mary Gibson, member of the Timok Tribe of Western Shoshone, Elko Band, and executive director of the NUWA Knowledge Center. Also, Fermina Stevens, a member of the Timok Tribe of Western Shoshone, and executive director of the Western Shoshone Defense Project. And now to a bit of self-promotion. The Sierra Nevada Ally was awarded with 5 awards from the Nevada Press Association for our impact journalism. So in honor of the announcement, we thought we'd highlight one of our winners, an explanatory piece from the Sierra Nevada Ally's Scott King. When we talk about renewable or green energy, we often focus on solar and wind energy, yet geothermal energy has huge potential across the United States, and especially here in Nevada. One research plant in neighboring Utah is exploring a new type of technology that could unlock the heat of the earth in places where this type of energy was previously not possible. But as our Scott King reports, without further funding beyond 2024, progress might be capped.
By the time the Department of Energy unveiled the fourth leg of its Energy Earthshot initiative last year, a project in South Central Utah had long been exploring the potential of geothermal energy in the United States. The Utah Frontier Observatory for Research in Geothermal Energy, otherwise known as Utah Forge, is an underground field laboratory specifically focused on an emerging field of research and development, enhanced geothermal systems, EGS. But without additional funding beyond 2024, a window of opportunity for developing geothermal energy in the U.S. could run out when Utah Forge's wells get plugged. The idea of EGS is to extract energy in the form of steam heat from the Earth's interior, not unlike what naturally occurs at geysers or hot springs. While these conventional geothermal systems occur naturally in some parts of the country, EGS provides an opportunity to expand geothermal's potential across the U.S., even in places where it would otherwise not occur.
The U.S. has tremendous unrealized geothermal potential,
said Dr. Joseph Moore, principal investigator at Utah Forge, during a recent Heat Beneath Our Feet webinar.
It is inexhaustible. It's enormous. Right? But you can't meet U.S. objectives of 60,000 megawatts or, you know, reducing the cost of EGS using conventional hot spring systems. They're just not big enough. We need to be able to drill everywhere across the country. And we know that we drill deep enough, we can always find the heat we're looking for.
Drilling, however, can come with risks. It can inadvertently cause earthquakes, and not all subterranean topography is suitable for an EGS to be economically efficient. In order for any geothermal system to be possible, 3 elements are needed: heat, fluid, and permeable rock. When all 3 elements occur naturally, like they do in much of Utah, Nevada, and the Mountain West, conventional systems like geysers or hot springs can form. When water is present as far as 4 miles below the Earth's surface, it becomes naturally heated from the rock found at these depths. Then, with the appropriate amount of pressure, this heated water propels upward through cracks toward the surface before being released in the form of steam. While heat is an omnipresent resource underneath the Earth's surface, 2 of the other key elements are often still missing: fluid and permeability.
Temperatures suitable for electric generation, which are about 300 F, can be found across the country at depths between 2 and 4 miles. However, in most places, the rocks at these depths lack the permeability that is required for natural circulation of water and heat extraction.
But that's where an EGS, like the Utah Forge Project, is exploring a solution.
EGS requires at least 2 wells, an injection well and a production well. Water is injected into the injection well, and we create fractures between the injection and production well, and then it's pumped out of the production well. It's cooled, and it's recirculated. So unlike, say, an oil and gas system where the water is removed and injected elsewhere, we circulate the water. And so it's constantly being recirculated into the ground and back into the reservoir.
As such, an EGS can simply be described as a man-made reservoir underneath the Earth's surface. When water from the injection well causes pre-existing fractures in the rock to reopen, permeability is created. The injected fluid becomes naturally heated by the internal temperatures of the Earth before the combination of heat and pressure forces it back to the surface through the production well in the form of steam, functioning like a geyser or hot spring. At a geothermal power plant, this steam is directed into a turbine that powers a generator, creating electricity. By harnessing this process, the DOE estimates that EGS could reliably power over 40 million homes nationwide, without the need for battery storage typically required with other, more transient renewable resources like solar and wind. Another unique component of geothermal energy, one that sets it apart from other renewables, is the relative efficiency it provides.
So the U.S. currently produces about 3,700 megawatts electric, and DOE has set a goal of 60,000 megawatts of electric energy by 2050. And if you kind of use the 1 megawatt per 1,000 homes, you can see how much energy that really is. So to go from 3,700 megawatts to 60,000 megawatts in the next 30 years is going to be very difficult.
That's why through its enhanced geothermal shot, the DOE is seeking to reduce the cost of EGS by 90% to $45 per megawatt hour by 2035. Utah Forge, a project conducted in partnership with the University of Utah, is funded by the DOE as a critical part of reaching that objective. While the potential for geothermal is great, Dr. Moore says the technology to utilize it is still developing. Tools melt due to the high temperatures, and power plants have had limited economic success.
15 different projects have been attempted throughout the world. None has produced what I would consider a commercial scale. And that means a system that is producing more than a few megawatts.
While it's not impossible to overcome these challenges and scale the level of geothermal energy production to meet the country's overall climate goals, high volumes of water must be pumped through the system's wells. This can be a significant challenge for arid states like Utah or Nevada. But that's also why the Milford location in south central Utah was selected as an ideal site for the Forge project.
There's no endangered species. There's no sage grouse here, prairie dogs. Makes it easy to work basically year round. You can see there's no human activity here, and there's no grazing, and there's no crop circles. And the reason that's the case is there's no potable water. So that the natural groundwater has relatively high concentrations of minerals that are toxic at high concentrations. And so the state does not allow the water to be used for grazing, for human consumption, for agriculture. And we, as Utah Forge, have leased that water.
But as a publicly funded project undertaking an expensive field of research, financial resources to keep the plant operational are not unlimited.
This is a field-scale laboratory. In fact, it's the only one in the world where tools and technologies for de-risking enhanced geothermal systems can be tested. One of the major problems we face is there is no incentive for industry to build tools. We don't have any EGS systems that are working for companies to spend their time building tools and spending millions of dollars. So that becomes a critical effort.
As it stands today, the Utah Forge project is funded by the DOE at $220 million through mid-2024.
That sounds like a tremendous amount of money, but 50% of the funds are obligated for project management and operations. Wells cost between $5 and $15 million. We have six of them already. Drill stimulations are $5 to $10 million. And then 50% of the funding is used for competitively bid R&D projects. And currently we're funding 17 of them at $50 million. So the money doesn't go as far as you might think.
Despite the high costs related to EGS research and development projects, Dr. Moore stresses the vital role geothermal energy can have in meeting clean energy goals and how a project like Utah Forge is critical to moving the entire industry forward.
It is an essential stepping stone to commercial large-scale EGS development. It is being used to develop the roadmap so that developers can take the roadmap and build the system. It also is important to realize worldwide, There is no other field scale EGS facility for research.
Now at the start of 2023, however, Dr. Moore and his team at Utah Forge are now facing an approaching deadline to achieve the remainder of their objectives. Negotiations with the DOE are ongoing, with hopes that the project can be extended to 2032.
At the end of 2024, I am required by the owners of land to plug and abandon the wells and regrade. So unless we have continued support for this, it's going to disappear and we will not have achieved objective of demonstrating the creation of an EGS.
That was the Sierra Nevada Allies' Scott King reporting. This piece was recognized by the Nevada Press Association in this year's awards for explanatory journalism. That's going to do it for Ally Radio this week. A big thank you to Mary Gibson, Fermina Stevens, and Scott King for being on the show. But before we go, let's wrap up with This Week in History. It was on this day 15 years ago that the U.S. economy began a downward spiral that became known as the Great Recession. On September 29, 2008, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 770 points, the most in any single day up to that point. The crash was preceded by the bankruptcies of major financial institutions caused by the housing crisis. The crash was immediately in response to the U.S. House of Representatives rejecting a bailout bill for these banks. Here is then-Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama talking about the bailout.
Now, the fact that we're even here voting on a plan to rescue our economy from the greed and irresponsibility of Wall Street and some in Washington is an outrage. It's an outrage to every American who works hard, pays their taxes, and is doing their best every day to make a better life for themselves and their families.
The bailout bill was ultimately passed 2 days later. The 2008 financial crisis had a global impact and led to further federal actions like lowering interest rates, additional bailouts, and increased financial regulation. Now let's finish up with our trivia question for the week. The 1863 Treaty of the Ruby Valley wasn't ratified until 1869, so our question this week is, who was the U.S. president in 1869 when that treaty was ratified? Was it Abraham Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, Andrew Jackson, or Andrew Johnson? 10 seconds, go. The answer is Ulysses S. Grant. The treaty was concluded in 1863, and ratification was advised in 1866 during President Andrew Johnson's tenure, but it wasn't proclaimed until the former Union General Grant took office in 1869, making this one of his first moves as president. Ally Radio is a partnership between the Sierra Nevada Ally and KNVC Carson City Community Radio, which broadcasts the show Fridays at noon. Support for our work comes from our readers and listeners at SierraNevadaAlly.org and KNVC.org. I'm Noah Glick, and until next time, let's be good to each other.